So after Schweitzer, this whole quest for the historical Jesus kind of took a pause. Come to an interim period where you have big names like Karl Barth, Rudolf Bultmann, who were very existentialist in their approach to theology. And existentialism has absolutely no interest in history. So they simply ignored this question entirely. But Bultmann, for example, he just put it out like this. I do indeed think that we can now know almost nothing concerning the life and personality of Jesus, since the early Christian sources show no interest in either. They are, moreover, fragmentary, often legendary, and other sources about Jesus do not exist. So Bultmann said, we don't know anything about the real person, Jesus. But that's okay. It's not a problem. Because existentialist theology does not depend upon historical anything or facts. It's all about your internal sense of calling. That's all that matters. Remember, I said for Bultmann, he used the illustration that it's like an onion. That you have the original person, Jesus of Nazareth, covered in layers of tradition, like an onion. So if you want to find the real historical Jesus, you peel the onion. What happens when you peel an onion? It gets smaller and smaller and smaller, and what are you left with? Nothing. Exactly. Bultmann used that analogy of an onion. And as you see, we're left with basically nothing. So according to Bultmann, did Jesus exist? Yes. Did he die on the cross? Yes. Or maybe, probably. Probably maybe. Yeah. Okay, did you get that? No, okay, didn't get close enough. When Bultmann says that there are no other sources of information about Jesus, and you said, well, there are, Jesus is referenced, referred to in other non-Christian historical sources like Josephus. We did this in apologetics. Do they deny that? No. He doesn't deny that. He admits the historical Jesus existed. But what Josephus, the Jewish historian, for example, he mentions Jesus twice. He tells us he was a teacher, that he had followers. But that's about it. He was crucified. But that's it. It's not that they deny those sources exist. They know those sources exist. They just don't tell us anything in detail. So like I said, for Bultmann, did Jesus exist? Yes. Josephus says so. There are these other sources that admit that there was a man named Jesus of Nazareth who was a teacher. But they don't give us any information. So Bultmann said, did he exist? Yes. Did he die on the cross? Maybe, probably, very likely. Did he rise from the dead? No, definitely not. According to Bultmann, the resurrection never happened. Definitely. That's a myth. Because anything supernatural is myth in his worldview. But he remains a Christian. He was a Christian member of a Christian church. I won't say what denomination, but you can maybe guess. For his whole life, as far as I know. Because from an existentialist perspective, it doesn't matter if Jesus never rose from the dead. All that matters is what it means to me in my heart, the personal experience I have with the story. That's all that matters. So the whole quest for the historical Jesus just took a pause during really for 50 years with the rise of existentialist philosophy. Then in 1953, one of Bultmann's former students launched a rebellion against his master. Ernst Caseman, in 1953, basically rebelled against Bultmann, kind of. And they started what would be called the new quest for the historical Jesus. Caseman said, yes, the Gospels have strong theological bias, as he put it. The Gospels are not trustworthy completely, according to Caseman. But it is still possible to separate the truth, the historical truth about Jesus, to separate it from the myth and legend. And so the new quest for the historical Jesus began. And guess what they found? They found a Jesus who taught very much like an existentialist philosopher. In other words, they found a Jesus that sounded a lot like them. And so again, critics started to look at that and say, look, you're doing the same thing all over again. You are looking down into the well of history and you see your own face reflected up at you and you say, oh, I discovered Jesus. But it's just your own reflection. Nothing more. And after about 30 years, this started to, or 20, 25 years, this started to run out of energy. By the late 1970s, this had pretty much, scholars lost interest in it. And that brings us then to the 1980s and what became known as the third quest for the historical Jesus. Starting in the 1980s and to some extent continuing still today, although it's not nearly as popular as it was a couple decades ago. And the influence here did not come from Germany. It came from America. But the man himself is German, Helmut Koester. It's a very German name. He is a German scholar, but he was teaching in Harvard, professor in Harvard University. And he is the one who starts what will be called the third quest. And it's separated because he does something that was very unexpected. He says, you know, we've been making a mistake. Everything that's been done up to this point has made a mistake. It has looked only at Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But there's also the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Peter, Gospel of Philip, Gospel of Mary Magdalene, Gospel of Judas. There's a whole list of other ancient writings about Jesus. Now, they're not in the Bible, but historians know them. We have copies of them. They exist. They are real. Real ancient documents about Jesus. And what Koester says is we need to look at those. Because according to Koester, he argued that these are actually older than Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. These are actually the first, most reliable sources of information about Jesus. And this is what was radical. And this is what changed everything. And this became very popular. A group of scholars in America got together and started calling themselves the Jesus Seminar. I mentioned Robert Funk a while ago, the dates that he gave for the Gospels. He was one of the founders. John Dominic Crossan is another very, very influential New Testament scholar. And these are a group of radical left-wing, radical liberal, radically, well, today would be called progressive. They're so liberal that most liberals think they are too liberal. They are the extremists. And they got together a group of their friends who are similar and formed what they call the Jesus Seminar. And they decided, well, we'll discuss what parts of the Gospels are authentic, what is real and what is not, what did the historical Jesus really say, and then we'll take vote. All our scholar friends, their little his circle of liberal extremists took a vote and published their findings. And I'll get to the findings in a minute. First is, but I want to just briefly just sort of introduce to you the methodology. How did they do this? The methodology of the third quest for the historical Jesus. This is, as I've said before, this is tradition criticism applied specifically to the Gospels and to the person of Jesus and teaching and the person of Jesus. And the first criteria that they use, and they explain this very clearly, the first criteria they use is the criteria of dissimilarity. Okay, dissimilarity. What this means is, if there is a statement that can be shown to be similar to something, let's say, a Jewish rabbi said, then we cannot be sure that this statement actually comes from Jesus. Because other Jewish rabbis were saying similar things. Therefore, we can't know that it really came from Jesus. It could have come from someone else. So in order to be authentic, it has to be dissimilar. It has to be different from anything the Jewish rabbis taught. And it has to be dissimilar, different from anything that the early church taught. Because if you have something that the early church taught, and you see it in the Gospels, you can't be sure that that actually comes from Jesus. That could be the early church putting their ideas into the mouth of Jesus. So the only parts of the Gospels that you can say are authentic, are definitely authentic to Jesus, are things that are dissimilar, different, either from the Jewish rabbis or from the Christian, well, let's say the Christian future of Jesus, of the Jesus movement. And that gives a bare minimum. This is their idea. This will give us a bare minimum of what is unique to Jesus. But does that sound very logical to you? No. Because it creates a Jesus who has no connection with his Jewish, let's say, past, his Jewish heritage, the Old Testament, the Jewish tradition, the Jewish religion. He has no connection with his, let's say, Jewish past, which is not logical, because Jesus used the same, well, what we call Old Testament. He's worshiping the same God, the God of Israel. There has to be similarity between Jesus and, let's say, the Jewish past or the Jewish present at his time. And there also logically has to be similarity between Jesus and the church that he founded. Because if the church was founded by Jesus, if the church looked back to Jesus as their leader, Messiah, God, the church must have taken from the teaching of Jesus. And so to say that the only things we can be sure are authentic are things that are different, effectively creates a Jesus that has no connection with his past, with the Jewish background he's coming out of, and no connection with the Christian movement of the future, which is completely nonsense. It's not logical. It's not a very logical criteria, but it is the criteria they used. The second criteria is criteria of multiple attestation, which basically says that having two witnesses is better than one. Is that true? If I have two witnesses to Daniil robbing a bank, it's better than if I only have one witness, right? Well, better. Better for who? Not better for you. You'll go to jail. Okay, obviously having two witnesses is better than one witness. And that's their principle. In order to be considered authentic, you have to have multiple witnesses. In order to say that Jesus really said this, it has to be recorded in multiple sources. And they assume the Oxford hypothesis. Like I said, everybody basically accepts this theory, which means Matthew, Mark, and Luke can't be really treated as independent sources or separate testimony. If something is in Mark and in Matthew, they would say that does not count as multiple attestation, two witnesses, because Matthew is using Mark as a source. So that's not two separate witnesses. It's simply Matthew repeating what he heard from Mark. So they basically then will treat, well, effectively then the synoptics become one witness. In order to be considered authentic, then, a statement of Jesus has to be in more than one independent source. So the synoptics, Matthew, Mark, or Luke, that would be one. And if it's also in John, well, then we have two. That would be two. Or if it is in Paul, that Paul refers to something Jesus said, that would be two. But I think you know, Paul says, actually quotes Jesus very, very little, very rarely, or Peter, or the epistles of John, or any of the other epistles. They actually don't quote Jesus very often. And there's very, very little that the Gospel of John has that is the same as Matthew, Mark, and Luke. They are mostly very separate, very different. Like I think I said when we went through this in New Testament survey, it gives me the impression that John knew Matthew, Mark, and Luke and intentionally wants to tell different stories. I'm not going to repeat myself. You already have that. I don't need to tell it over again. I'm going to tell you something new. There's very little that actually is in both. But according to them, there have to be multiple independent sources. So if you take the synoptics as one, okay, this is one, then it has to be also in either John or Paul or the other epistles. And they also include the Gospel of Thomas, Gospel of Peter, Gospel of Mary Magdalene, Gospel of Philip. We're going to talk more about those in a little bit. I'm assuming you've heard of their existence. We'll talk more about them in a little bit. They include those as well because they believe they are reliable sources as well. But again, what you're left with is very little. Because this criteria by itself basically cuts out the entire Gospel of John. Because basically, I mean, most of the stories in the Gospel of John are only in John. And of course, well, it cuts out almost everything. It leaves us with very, very little, the way this is done. And they actually say that's their point. Okay, but before we get to that, let's just sort of pause for a minute and ask, is that a logical criteria? In order to consider something true, is it absolutely logically necessary that you have two eyewitnesses? Okay, Daniil is accused of robbing a bank. Is it possible that there's only one eyewitness? And it really happened. He really did rob the bank, but there's only one eyewitness. Is that logically possible? Yes, there are many things that happen in life where there's only one eyewitness. Do we automatically say, oh, it never happened because there's only one eyewitness? We can't trust because there's only one eyewitness. Would you say that? No. Of course, if there's two, three, four independent eyewitnesses, that gives you better evidence. But just because there's only one eyewitness doesn't mean we have to logically conclude that we can't trust that Jesus said this. So this criteria is not logical. It's too narrow. It's too restrictive. Both of these criteria are actually designed intentionally to be like that, to give us a bare minimum, a tiny amount that we have good evidence for. We have good evidence that this really is unique to Jesus. This really happened because we have multiple testimonies. A bare minimum that gives really strong evidence that this is authentic. That's actually intentionally what they're doing. And that brings then their third criteria, which is the criteria of coherence. If these two give us a bare minimum, then the criteria of coherence says we start with this, and then anything that is coherent with what we know is authentic, anything that is consistent, that fits together, we can add that as well. So that's their strategy in this. They're not trying to be illogical. They are trying to get a small amount that we can be definite about, and then we can add in extra that we consider to be coherent with what we know from points one and two. But of course, this is going to be extremely subjective, what is coherent. And as we'll see, this in reality is going to be an issue. And all of this is part of tradition criticism. And remember, tradition criticism says that we're dealing with a time period when the stories are passed around by word of mouth, which means in order to be memorized and passed around by word of mouth, they have to be very short. And so they cut things down as short as possible. That's part of the tradition criticism that we saw earlier. So, for example, the parable of the weeds. Okay, this is just one example. This is from a book that John Dominic Crossan wrote, one of the supporters of this whole movement, The Essential Jesus. I have it on my shelf somewhere in my office. It's not worth reading, to be honest. That's just my opinion. And he is presenting what he thinks is the essential Jesus. This is the real Jesus. And he's going through the parables. And he says, this parable is authentic. The weeds sown in the farmer's field. I assume you're familiar with the parable. If not, you can look it up on your own. Now, if you open it up in Matthew, there's the parable, and then Jesus gives an explanation. The weeds sown in the field, what does it mean? Jesus explains it. Okay, and that happens very often with Jesus' parables. First, he gives the parables, and then he sits down with his disciples and said, now let me explain this to you. Very common. And if you read through the Matthew 13, it all makes sense. But according to Crossan, the parable is authentic to Jesus, but the explanation is not. The explanation is a later addition. It's only the parable that's authentic. So then what does the parable mean? Well, he says, the story is simple enough, but how was the kingdom of God like that for the historical Jesus? It's easy enough to see how Matthew tells it and interprets it. But what about Jesus himself? We don't know. And for every single parable in this book, he does the same thing. He goes through and the parable is authentic. Jesus really told this parable, but the explanation is not. So we can't trust that. So what does it mean? And sometimes Crossan will just say, well, we really don't know. Sometimes he will know, and he'll say, it means this. But guess what? His meaning will be radically different from what Matthew actually explains. So he assumes that Matthew has it wrong, and then he gives the right interpretation, which is totally different. And he does this consistently. So what are we left with? Well, Crossan was one of the scholars involved in this movement that was called the Jesus Seminar. And I told you they voted. They actually voted with colored beads. Like different colored beads, and everyone has their beads, and they pass around a basket, and everybody put the bead in the basket. Is this verse authentic to Jesus? And you vote with your bead. It was after a long discussion, actually years of discussing and debating, and they voted with their colored beads. Only 2% of the words of Jesus recorded in the Gospels, they said, actually come from Jesus. 2%. 14% are not the words of Jesus, but it reflects something he would have said. So, okay, so it's a real paraphrase, but it's consistent with something he would have said. 27%, vaguely similar to something he might have said, but it's like, okay, this is getting really far away. Vaguely similar to something he might have said. 57% definitely do not reflect something Jesus would have said. It's not a paraphrase, it's just completely wrong. Jesus would never have said anything like this. 57%. Now, as I mentioned, Crossan, Funk, the people that made up the Jesus Seminar, represent the radical left wing, the radical, what would today be called progressive, liberal, whatever words are kind of strange and not always helpful, but they represent the radical extreme. The majority of, let's say, mainstream liberal, respected liberal scholars, critical scholars, looked at the methodology of the Jesus Seminar and said, these guys are just too radical. This is not good methodology. So they don't represent, let's say, respected mainstream liberal position. They represent a radical position. But even among the, let's say, mainstream respected liberal side of scholars involved with this, they don't vote and they don't give exact numbers, but the differences are not actually that big. For example, it's very, very common for them to say that basically the whole Gospel of John is fiction. It's very, very common for John to be almost completely ignored or, well, just labeled as fiction. So that's a quarter of the Gospels right there. And much of Matthew, Mark, and Luke as well, they will also argue are not authentic to Jesus. We're not going to get into this in too much detail. What I want to point out is this. Robert Funk is an honest man, mostly. At least in my opinion, what I've read of his, I can respect that he tries to be honest. So, for example, he admits very clearly, methodology is not an indifferent net. It catches what it is designed to catch. Their method that they're doing is not objective, ultimately. It's designed to catch what it's supposed to catch. He's being honest. And that's exactly what we see. Modern portraits of Jesus, these people who try to discover who was the real Jesus of Nazareth. And if you go on YouTube, you can find videos. I've already found out, yeah, people don't watch TV anymore. I'm old. I still watch TV. Discovery Channel, National Geographic, they have, well, National Geographic will have articles occasionally about this, but you can find documentaries that they make about the historical Jesus. Who was Jesus really? And you'll hear all sorts of ideas. For example, well, just to start with John Dominic Crossan, the one I've referred to a few times already. According to him, Jesus could be best described as a Cynic philosopher, which was a specific in the Greek philosophical world of that time, there was this category of philosophy of the Cynics. And basically, it's a Jesus who, according to Crossan, basically like sits under the tree on the hillside, just talks with his disciples and just kind of talks about the meaning of life and be good to people and make love, not war. In other words, basically, Marti, kaks kolmaa on vaja, se on peaaegu surnud, kui on siin ma leidsin. Kas on kuskil?
Kolmaad.
Aitäh. Crossan presents Jesus very much like one of the hippie era gurus who sat outside with their guitar, and that's the way he presents Jesus. That's the result of his historical conclusion. And basically, Jesus was a hippie, one of these hippie leaders or today that would be called, what's the word, what's the phrase? Mitte hipster. Hipster on midagi hoopis muud. Not hipster. Influencer. A hippie era influencer. And by the way, that's exactly the generation Crossan comes from. Growing up in the 1960s, 1970s, exactly that era. Another scholar who's done a lot of work on Jesus is a Jewish, Another person who has done a lot of work on the historical Jesus is Elizabeth Schussler-Fiorenza. who comes to the conclusion that Jesus was a feminist. That Jesus' basic mission, his basic message, was to end patriarchal, patriarchy, to support feminists, to support women. That was the basic heart of Jesus' message. Now, do you want to make a guess about her personal, identity? Yeah, surprisingly enough, she is herself a very strong feminist. Interesting how that works out. Now, another individual who's done a lot of work on Jesus is a scholar by the name of Giza Vermees. He's written books about Jesus, and his conclusion is that Jesus was a very conservative Jew. Jesus did not fight with the Pharisees. He agreed with the Pharisees. He was a friend of the Pharisees. Jesus was a very strong Jew. Do you want to guess Giza Vermees' background? Yes, he is himself Jewish, Orthodox Jewish. He is not a follower of Jesus. He is an, I don't know about Orthodox Jew, but he is, yeah, Jewish, not a Messianic Jew. Interesting. Now, in contrast to that, there's a scholar named Robert Price. I didn't get this translated into Russian. Need to do that after. Robert Price, who says the exact opposite. Jesus was not a faithful Jew. Jesus actually was the exact opposite. He was very much against all the Jewish traditions. And he wanted to totally turn his back on Judaism. And according to Robert Price, it's actually the first generation of Jesus followers who Judaized Jesus. They made Jesus more Jewish than he actually was. So it's the exact opposite of Giza Vermees. Interesting. Typically, there are a lot of commonalities some of them are strange, but the typical Jesus that's presented, if you Google or YouTube search for documentaries about the historical Jesus, typically what you'll find is that the historical Jesus did not call himself God, did not consider himself to be personally important. Okay, he is not important. On the contrary, the basic message of Jesus was a message of equality. That's what Jesus was trying to spread, a message of equality, that all are equal and all are welcome. So Jesus did not consider himself to be special because we're all equally special. So he did not consider himself to be the Messiah. He did not heal physically, but he did heal psychologically. He healed their emotional wounds, but not physically. He did no miracles, nothing that would be considered prophecy. He definitely did not believe that his death would be atoning for sin. He definitely did not believe he would die for the sins of people. And very important, he did absolutely nothing to anger the Jewish religious leaders. He never condemned the Pharisees. This is very, very important in the third quest for the historical Jesus. Jesus was very careful not to say anything that might be labeled as anti-Semitic. Because we all know how horrible anti-Semitism is. Now, of course, anti-Semitism is bad. I don't want to sound like I'm being sarcastic here. Anti-Semitism is bad. And Jesus was very careful not to say anything that could be interpreted as an attack on the Jewish leaders or society. Jesus was very careful about that. What have they done? Who have they discovered? Themselves. Once again, they are looking down into the well of history, and they see their own face reflected back at them. They find a Jesus who fits today's world, well, today's Western world. They're all Western individuals, who fits the current cultural world. They find a Jesus actually who has far more in common with Karl Marx than he does with Mark, Matthew, Luke, or John. I mean, a Jesus who is very careful to avoid anti-Semitism. It's so obvious that this is happening after World War II. And I mean, as I said, anti-Semitism is horrible, absolutely, obviously. But you cannot take our attitudes to how, to our sensitivity to the horrible things that have happened today and say, well, Jesus must have been aware of that. The same with feminism. Trying to make Jesus in the first century Judea, and trying to portray Jesus as a feminist, it doesn't fit their historical context at all. It doesn't make sense back then. Again, they've looked down into the well of history and found their own reflection bouncing back at them. Now, before we take a break, I want to just comment. I'm presenting this search for the historical Jesus as something, well, tragic, in my opinion. And these examples are, in my opinion, tragic. However, from the very beginning, going back to the 19th century, there were also conservative Christians who believed Jesus is God, Savior of the world, rose from the dead, who also have been involved in trying to understand better the historical Jesus of Nazareth. Here's just a few books. We have all of these in our library. All of these are worth reading. I think the Kuli, maybe did Kuli show you this one? Jesus Through Middle Eastern Eyes. I know she's been using this for her Jesus in the Gospels class. These are all conservative scholars who believe Jesus is who the church says Jesus is, but have been very, very active in trying to understand better how Jesus fits into first century Jewish society. In other words, they're not trying to change Jesus or to say that Jesus is different. They just want to understand the way the first century Jewish people would have understood Jesus and that connection. And so there have been some very, very good things written by people who really believe in Jesus that also fit into this category, the search for the historical Jesus. This man here, Ben Witherington III. He has been to Estonia. He taught for us once. He teaches at Asbury Seminary, where Stevie Barola, Ken Collins, he's their coworker, and he is excellent. So there's a lot of good that has come out of this too, to help us better understand the message of Jesus in its historical context. But they're not trying to recreate Jesus. That's something very, very different. Okay, so as I said, when you hear the phrase the historical Jesus, don't think only about people who are trying to change Jesus. There are some very, very good, there's some very, very good work that's been done that all of us can benefit from as well. Okay, time for another break. Any quick questions, comments? Otto actually wrote in the chat, it has been a common religious tradition among men throughout the centuries to discover an image of God that suits their sins. Absolutely. That's human nature. The problem with Jesus, the real Jesus, for most people, is that Jesus ultimately demands that you kneel before him and repent. I mean, like Jesus said to the woman caught in adultery, go and sin no more. It's that demand for a changed life. And so it's much easier to create a God that suits us, to create a Jesus that suits us, who doesn't demand that moment of kneeling before him. That's human nature. That's sinful nature, of course. Absolutely, Otto, that's absolutely correct. And that is exactly what's going on through all of this, on a deep personal spiritual level. It is an unwillingness to kneel before God and accept God, you are God. Sadly.